The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, good afternoon. Great to see you here. Almost springtime. Beautiful day outside. I remember a conversation I had with my boss just over 30 years ago. I was a fresh-faced university graduate, just done a marketing degree, working for a part of the TNT Transport Group. Now, if you're a little older, you remember when TNT was kind of one of the biggest, hottest companies in town. Sir Peter Abels was kind of at the top of the business food chain, and I was a little part of his empire. And I remember my boss was a kind of a hard-driven, high flyer. Who treated me very well. He took me aside one day and spoke to me privately. We were just having a little chat, and he said, "Alan, I want to tell you a story." And then he told me a very politically incorrect parable. Here it is. He said, "I want you to imagine a man walks into a bar and sees a beautiful woman sitting on her own. And he walks up to her, sits beside her, and says, 'Excuse me, madam, would you sleep with me for $1 million? She says, $1 million? Yes, I would. He said, Would you sleep with me for $50? She said, "Certainly not. What do you think I am?" He said, "Well, we've established that. Now what we're doing is haggling." Okay. I didn't laugh. No, that's right. And then my boss looked at me and he said, "Now you understand that story, don't you? What it means is we all have our price. Just make sure yours is a good one." And what he was teaching me was to look that people sell their souls, or people sold their souls to the company for a price. And that's what I saw. As a young man, I looked around and saw older men, it was mainly men rather than women, but older men who had spent so much time at the company, partly working and partly just playing the game to be seen, that the rest of their life was a mess and their relationships were hopeless, and so they didn't have a life outside of work. They'd sold their soul, but they'd made it to the top or close to the top. Now, as a society, we keep saying that relationships are the most important thing in life. And yet, we act, well, as our experts were just saying on the panel, we keep on by our actions showing that relationships are for sale. And I wonder today, as we come to the fourth of our series of four rich men that Jesus interacts with in Luke's Gospel, whether it's worth stopping and thinking in your own life, have you sold your soul? Do you have a price? Because the man we look at today in Luke chapter 19, the one that's described in the story that's in your handout, had sold his soul. Jesus meets him as Jesus is walking south. Since chapter 9 in Luke's Gospel, he began up in chapter 9 up in Lake Galilee, and he's walked 100 or more kilometres now, walking south towards Jerusalem, and he gets to Jericho. He's only 27 kilometres from Jerusalem, 27 kilometres from where he knows he'll be crucified. And as he walks through Jericho, see chapter 19, verse 1, Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. Jericho is a very famous city in the ancient world. It was a major trading and commercial centre, and so a major centre where the Romans, the conquering Romans, collected taxes. And we're told in verse 2, a man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. Now, the name Zacchaeus actually means clean or innocent. And I'm sure he was the time that his mum and dad named him. Oh, here he is, isn't he cute? We'll call him Zacchaeus. But by the time he'd reached this stage, probably middle age, he was despised by the community around him. Why? Because tax collectors, well, the Romans were clever. What they did was they subcontracted out the collection of taxes to indigenous people, right, to the homegrown people in the areas that they conquered. They understood how the society worked, and they were able to get even more tax out of people, and this was a system rife, open to abuse and extortion and so on. And he had become very rich, but at the cost of being despised by his fellow Jews. When it says he was a chief tax collector, it's hard to know whether he was just very, very good at it, or he actually had, in that area, a whole series of people that subcontracted to him. So he was no doubt very rich. So if you want to get the right kind of picture in your head of Zacchaeus. Sometimes, you know, if you went to Sunday school as a child, there's all those cute little drawings. Now, don't think that. Think short, hard, determined, wealthy. How about this man? Danny DeVito. Now, that's Zacchaeus, isn't it? All right, short, tough, in your face. And you know, he was rich and he had status. And that's what he wanted. Now, maybe they didn't love him, but, ooh, they respected him, especially when he walked down the street with his minders. And what had he done? Well, he ignored the relationships in his life, sold them for the sake of having more and more material stuff because his status and his security came from what he owned. And we sit here and think, well, you know, we're in City Bible Forum, so we're all thinking good thoughts and so on, of course, and we sit here and think, what a fool to sell his soul for money. And yet, if we have eyes to see it, our society is just rushing down that path as we sell our relationships and the time that it takes to have relationships. We just sell it for more and more stuff. And one of the few voices that actually speaks against it is Ross Gittins, one of the men that was on the forum here just a little while ago. Ross Gittins writes very interesting articles in the Herald on the 4th of April. Let me read you a little one that what he has to say about us rushing down this path to sell relationships and so on. He says this: whether or not they realise what they're doing, Australia's business people, economists and politicians are in the process of dismantling the weekend and phasing out public holidays. Australia, dismantling the weekend, how can that be? And they're doing it in the name of making us think we're better off. He goes on to say that historically it's penalty rates and regulated trading hours that have stopped that happening. But in April, he says, last week the New South Wales government moved to join Victoria in allowing all shops, not just those in the CBD, to open on Boxing Day. Now, say the retailers, all we need is for restrictions to be lifted on Easter Sunday. And this week, the major banks revealed their intention to push for the definition of ordinary hours in the National Banking Award to be extended to include Saturday afternoons and all of Sundays. Who works for the banks? Yay, isn't that great news? Yeah, uh-huh. And what's the bank's justification for seeing such a change? They say to promote flexible and efficient modern work practices in a way that has proper regard for the considerations of productivity and employment costs. Gittins continues, ah, yes, it would make the economy more flexible and efficient and raise productivity. Well, in that case, say no more. Silly me. But one of the questions he asks is, why does being able to buy more stuff make up for husbands and wives being able to see less of each other? For having less time with the kids, having a lot more trouble getting together with your friends and having your day off when everyone else is at school or working? Why is this an attractive future? Why should our elective representatives reorganise our economies in ways that suit business and promote consumption, but do so at the expense of employees' private lives? The answer's simple. We keep electing them to do that. This is a classic case of business people, economists and politicians urging on us a mentality that prioritises the economic, the material, over other dimensions of our lives. Yet again, no one pauses to ask what these reforms will do to our relationships. No one's asked that except maybe Ross Gittins and a few other voices. And if you look at the way we're travelling and heading, and willingly do so, we elect the governments, we buy the shares in the companies that do this, we're in grave danger of ending up with full pockets and empty lives. Now, that's the title of another article that I found this week, Full Pockets and Empty Lives, A Psychoanalytic Exploration of the Contemporary Culture of Greed. I thought it's time that we just kind of ratcheted up the kind of academic level here and so on. Written by Paul L. Watchtell of the USA in 2003. And there is a man with a serious moustache, I think. So one of the great moustaches of the world, I would say. Now, I bought the article online. It's interesting. He says, what the article's all about, 20 pages of academic work and so on. He's trying to work out... It's an article written about the USA, but just direct application here. He's trying to work out why is it that people so single-mindedly chase after more and more possessions when psychological study after study after study show that more and more possessions don't make you happier. And he's trying to work it out. Now, what was interesting was to read all of that and look, What the research shows is what basically is common sense. If you sit down and think about it, all of this just kind of, yeah, it's common sense, but it's interesting what the research also shows is most people don't think about it. So he talks about, for example, the King Midas story or myth. Remember Midas, and he ends up being able to touch things and they all turn to gold, and eventually he turns his daughter into gold and it all goes pear-shaped. He says this, "But the insight in the Midas story points to what might be called the tragedy of insatiability. The greedy individual may be morally reprehensible, but he is also likely to be unable to achieve genuine contentment or satisfaction. Indeed, one of my central interests is understanding the difference between the individual who strives restlessly but does experience satisfaction as a result, and the individual for whom insatiability is a curse, for whom the desire for money and wealth is a hunger that cannot be satisfied." How would you recognise insatiability in a society or an individual? It's worth thinking about, isn't it? No matter how much you have, it's never enough. He talks about greed and envy in the article, but doesn't really, not clear in delineating between the two. He says money gives us this fantasy that it's the potential to have whatever we want and be satisfied at some time. He talks about money as a symbol of success. He also talks about the effect that shopping has on people. Here's one. We're all familiar with the quip, when the going gets tough, the tough go shopping. It's hard to imagine that quip emerging from Castro's Cuba, and certainly not from a tribe in the Amazon. Ours is a society that offers shopping as a solution to feelings of emptiness, worthlessness, depressed mood, and so forth. And I think it's interesting. You walk into a new Westfields shopping centre, like Miranda Fair or Westfields at Bondi Junction, and you see the high ceilings and the glass and the calming music, and I think it feels just like a cathedral. A new and shiny one, but a cathedral. And he goes on to say, Dr. Watchtell goes on to say, people ratchet up their expectations over time. So the family, a modern family now, would be particularly unhappy to try and live in a house that was perfectly adequate in the 1950s or 60s. And he talks about the fact that if your peer group all the standards of living for a peer group rise, it does nothing for anyone's satisfaction. He says this, economists tell us that a rising tide lifts all boats, but they deny the comparative effect that is so obvious to casual observation and so well documented by social psychologists. When the tide rises, everyone still feels they are at sea level. True. Then he talks about the way that we kind of rationalise things. What is less likely to be clearly perceived is that the ways members of our society organise their lives in pursuit of these continually escalating consumption standards are not always beneficial to their relationships or their children. It is perhaps the guilt or shame they feel in the unacknowledged recognition that their children often pay a price for what their parents need to maintain their own self-esteem in a highly competitive society. And that accounts for the great American, and I could say Australian, mantra, I'm doing this for my family. Really? One last quote. He says, no one says to himself or herself, I think I'll validate myself and hold myself together with money. What I am describing is something that goes on unconsciously, adding further to the dismay and internal pressure to have more money. And the great, I think, unanswered question that he raises is this. The quest for more and more money and material goods fills a hunger that comes from elsewhere. Fills a hunger that comes from elsewhere. It is a task of psychological analysis to discover where that hunger comes. Let me read that properly. It is the task of psychological analysis to discover from where that hunger comes. And so he says we've got to look into sociology and economic history. And the one voice that he doesn't listen to, I think, is where the answer actually comes from. And so we rush on to need more and more and more. If you want to read about that, Richard Dennis and Clive Hamilton, their book Affluenza, they're both great writers and good-looking too, I think. Their book talks about the great costs in Australia of our pursuit, endless pursuit of wealth. In 2005, we were working the longest hours of any country in the OECD. They talk about the huge effect on our health, on our family life, and so on. We're in the middle of 2009 ComSec report. We're now building the biggest new houses and apartments in the world. There's suburbs in Sydney that are now where the houses are so big, we don't have ride-on lawnmowers, we have ride-on vacuum cleaners. And yet they're empty during the day while we work incredible hours to pay for them, and we're time poor, relationally poor. What was it Mr. Watchtell said? The quest for more and more money and material goods fills a hunger that comes from elsewhere. And what's the voice that he didn't consult? In the 5th century, St. Augustine, famous Christian writer, wrote this at the beginning of his Confessions, like his autobiography. He says this, God, you have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless till they find their rest in you. God, you have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless till they find their rest in you. And I suspect Zacchaeus, this little hard businessman, felt that restlessness, that all of the money and all of the work and all of the pushing hadn't really satisfied. And he neglected the most important relationship of all. He'd actually neglected the relationship with his Creator, the one that gave him life in the first place. And he was rich but spiritually bankrupt, and he knew from being taken along to the synagogue as a little boy, from being read the Old Testament, that there would be a judgment day, that God would demand an accounting for what Zacchaeus had done with the life he'd been given, how he treated his Creator and how he treated other people. And I think it's that restlessness that meant he wanted to see this young prophet from up north who taught amazing things. And so you see verse 3, he wanted to see who Jesus was, but being a short man, he could not because of the crowd. And so he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. Now, here's a picture of a sycamore fig tree. They're trees that grow fairly low to the ground. They have wide lateral branches and so on, so not too hard to climb. But it's funny, really. I've known this story for, I don't know, 30, 40 years, whatever. It's only after I turned 50 that I understand. Middle-aged men don't climb trees. I can't remember the last time I climbed a tree. What does it show? He's desperate. He really, really wants to see Jesus. It's a little desperate and very embarrassing. And you know what? Wanting to see Jesus today, it can still be embarrassing, can't it? To kind of take that first step, to want to know about him and so on. I understand. I get that. But you see what happens in verse 5. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today. Now, we don't know how Jesus knew Zacchaeus' name. It could have been a kind of a supernatural divine appointment thing. Yep, maybe it was. But maybe too, when you're walking along and you see a well-dressed middle-aged man who's climbed a tree and kind of, I think Jesus may have been perceptive enough to realize, this guy needs to have a talk about something. What's his name? Zacchaeus. And he calls him down. I don't know how it happened. But I know Zacchaeus is very pleased. Verse 6. So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. All the people saw this and began to mutter, he has gone to be the guest of a sinner. I mean, what's Jesus doing? You just don't... These people are outside polite society. He's broken all the religious rules. This guy's a low life. As a religious leader, you just don't associate with those people. Because to eat with someone means you accept them. Especially in the first century. It meant you accepted them, you embraced them, and that's exactly what Jesus did, and it scandalized the crowd. But you see what Zacchaeus does? Now, verse 8, but Zacchaeus stood up, and we're not sure when that happens. Is it immediately? It may actually be after they've had a meal together, after they've had time to talk. But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor. And if I cheated anybody out of anything, I'll pay back four times the amount. Now, that's a loaded paragraph, isn't it? Do you notice right at the beginning, what is it that Zacchaeus calls Jesus? Look, Lord. Lord or Master, the word means. If you were here last week, we talked about the character generally known as the rich young ruler in chapter 18. He comes to Jesus and calls Jesus good teacher. And there's all the difference in those two words. Good teacher versus Lord or Master. And Zacchaeus has accepted, understood that Jesus is God's king and Jesus is his master, Lord or master. Last week, Jesus talked about the rich man who walked away and couldn't follow him, couldn't walk away from his wealth. And Jesus said how hard it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God, to be friends with God, have God's king. It's like a camel going through the eye of a needle. It's just not possible. And yet Jesus says nothing's impossible with God. And what's happened? God's grabbed this hard little man's heart and changed it so that he wants to live with Jesus as his master. Now, Luke tells us his story in shorthand. But if you had time, and I hope if you haven't that you might, if you had time to read all 24 chapters of Luke's Gospel, what we could pour into this story, what's going on here? Well, at least three things that happen with Zacchaeus. First one is this: he's been accepted or loved by God. You see, the message is not, Zacchaeus, get your life in order and then come and see me. I've come to your house today, Zacchaeus. It's immediate acceptance. To anyone who wants to know Jesus, anyone who will come to him, immediately accept it. Second thing, he's been forgiven. Because, you know, Zacchaeus has done some very serious stuff. And I don't just mean, you know, extortion or fraud or corruption or theft. That's bad. But he's done something much worse. Because Jesus says the number one commandment, the greatest commandment is this: love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength. Love God with everything you've got. Love the one who gives you life itself. Give him your life. And Zacchaeus has spent his life ignoring the one who gives him life and living for possessions. And he deserves to be separated from God in eternity. Jesus' word for that is hell. And yet Zacchaeus has done all of that, insulted God, ignored him. But how can Jesus just forgive him? Answer: Jesus is 27 kilometres away from paying the penalty for Zacchaeus. In just a few weeks, Jesus will be in Jerusalem and will die in his place, in my place, in your place, so that we could be forgiven. Free forgiveness, but costly for Jesus. Accepted, forgiven. And then the third thing, with Jesus as Lord, you can start fixing up your life. It's not that you earn forgiveness by being good, but once Jesus is your master, you start to see things clearly. And so, for example, with Zacchaeus, possessions stop being Zacchaeus' master and possessions become Zacchaeus' servant. He can actually begin to use them the right way. And that's why, well, he gives away half his possessions to the poor. Why? He's got more than he needs. And then he says about repay people four times. If I've cheated anyone, I'll pay back four times the amount. Why four times? As far as I can work out, in the book of Exodus, which sort of set up the Old Testament law, if you stole a sheep and you were caught, so you steal the sheep and then there's a knock at the door and you've got kind of the lamb roast and wearing the Ugg boots and that's it, you're busted. You had to pay back four times the amount. Four sheep if you stole one. And I think what Zacchaeus is saying is he'll bring even his money, even his past, under the lordship of Jesus. And so I'll pay back four times to anyone that I've stolen from. What's he saying? Yeah. Be generous. Make restitution where you can. Does that hurt? No. I tell you what's interesting. You see, in verse 6, Zacchaeus welcomes Jesus gladly. Last week, Luke tells us the rich young ruler who gave up nothing and walked away, he walked away sadly. The one who gives up nothing, keeps it all for himself, walks away sadly. Zacchaeus welcomes Jesus, gives away so much, and does it gladly. What is it that Jesus says? Verse 9. Craig, we'll just leave that next slide out. We'll just go to verse 9. Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because this man too is a son of Abraham." What's he meaning? Zacchaeus is no longer separated from God. He's actually been welcomed back. And the son of Abraham idea, well, in one sense, yes, he's a Jewish man. He's physically descended from Abraham. But in the Old Testament, Abraham's the example of the man who truly trusted God. And so for those who trust God, they're sons, daughters of Abraham. They share his faith or his trust. And then Jesus says, do you notice verse 5? He says, today I must come to your house. And in verse 9 he says, today salvation has come to this house. And that is where Jesus is. There's rescue and forgiveness. In the Bible's term, salvation, which is exactly what he says in verse 10. For the Son of Man, his way of talking about himself, the Son of Man came to seek and to save what was lost. And folks, without Jesus, we are lost. Without Jesus, we're separated from God. Without Jesus, we're unforgiven. Without Jesus, very often, we're actually finding our security, our significance in stuff that we own. And what does Jesus offer? Acceptance, forgiveness, and getting life in order. I'd like to offer you the chance to do business with Jesus now, to actually pray to him, as Craig said we would at the beginning. Let me show you the kind of prayer. It'll be printed in your program, or it'll be on the screen. Here's the kind of prayer I think you can say to Jesus, yes, that's what I want, that acceptance and forgiveness. Dear God, I admit I've not treated you as I should. I've lived with other things at the centre of my life and not you, the one who gives me life. Please forgive me because Jesus died in my place. Please help me to live with Jesus as my Lord and to trust him in all parts of my life to bring them under his control. That's a prayer very much like the one I prayed 30-something years ago to become a follower of Jesus. I give you a moment, and then I'm going to pray it sentence by sentence, and I invite you, if you'd like to pray it to God in the silence of your own heart. He promises that he'll hear. So I'll pause for a moment, and then I'll pray it sentence by sentence, and if you would like to pray, be assured God will hear you. Dear God, I admit I've not treated you as I should. I've lived with other things at the centre of my life and not you, the one who gives me life. Please forgive me because Jesus died in my place. Please help me to live with Jesus as my Lord and to trust him in all parts of my life to bring them under his control. Amen.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.